Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, along with Tom Keene and Jonathan Farrow. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance on demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Francis Donald joins us now. Francis, do you think they're done? And welcome to the show.
They might be done. Who knows? It could be another 25 basis points or nothing. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't think it really matters. The market already has a coin toss for this next meeting. What matters and what actually shocks my economic and inflation model is not another 25 basis points or not. It's how fast they cut and when they start cutting. So the conversation is going to have to shift, I think, in the next few weeks away from this next incremental meeting towards what does the path to the next 1 to 2 years look like? Because if the Fed is going to get its way, there's a significant mispricing. I suspect that the market is probably going to have to price in more cuts moving forward, and the Fed is going to follow.
What drives that? The economic data or further financial instability?
The two, and this was the big difference, Lisa. You talked about the difference between the ECB and the Fed. The ECB, President Lagarde, told us there is no tension between the price stability and financial stability mandate. And even though Chair Powell implied the banking system is sound, he also was very clear that they were incorporating real economic impact from the banking stress through the lending channel. So we know that this is going to dampen growth moving forward. And indeed, anyone with an economic model, the day that we saw the first initial banking stress clued in, this is going to be a credit crunch. And we have a playbook for that. It's not good. It leads to recessions. It has every single time.
Francis, we've heard from executive after executive. This is not a credit crunch. This isn't a credit problem. This is simply a liquidity mismatch. How do you say to them, you're wrong, this is going to become a credit problem, as it always has with liquidity issues, versus, no, you're right, this is something that could be addressed with deposit insurance or other measures?
I just pull out my charts from before the banking stress issues, in which we already saw senior loan officers telling us that we were in a sizable tightening. This was happening before we experienced banking stress. So even if you want to say the impact is nil, I could still prove to you that we are actually seeing a wide range of data saying that credit is pulling back. And that's particularly important because the bull case for the U.S. economy has been the consumer is strong and the consumer was being driven by releveraging. If that slows or stalls, then we have a momentum slowing. Is that Q1, Q2? Probably not. But our traditional leads and legs tell us that by Q4 of this year, we're in a significant soft patch. So my issue is, well, maybe the Fed goes 25 basis points or not. I think not at this juncture. But how quickly do they choose to respond? And it's possible that the hawkish take here is not the next meeting, but that they try to stay on pause as long as possible, given inflation in this soft patch is probably still a little uncomfortably high.
From what I'm hearing, Francis, it seems like the threshold has gone way down for cutting rates, at least what you expect in the upcoming months. How low do you expect the Fed to be able to cut rates, given that there is a disinflationary effect from some sort of credit contraction?
Well, that's right. We have playbooks for uncertainty shocks, which the banking system stress is. We have playbooks for credit crunches. But it's been a very long time, Lisa, since we had a playbook for low growth, but inflation still around 3 to 4%. The most important thing I heard from Chair Powell yesterday was actually his reference to long-term inflation expectations being anchored. And he said it was true for households, businesses, forecasters, and markets. And that may be the direction that Chair Powell and the Fed chooses to tilt towards as we still see some cyclically high inflation. So even if they come to the end of the year and we have 3-4%, they may be able to say, listen, the long-run concerns about inflation expectations becoming de-anchored, we no longer have those. We can tilt back towards the employment side of our mandate. Because let's remember, the Fed does have a dual mandate. We just haven't talked about the employment side in a very long time.
John and I were talking about this earlier, Francis. Do you think that rate cuts in this framework are going to be bullish, are going to be positive for risk assets?
Well, traditionally, the context around rate cuts matters, but we got to get through a recession first. I mean, there is a little bit of something we're seeing now where people are saying, well, the leading indicators of the leading indicators of the leading indicators are positive, but that's jumping the gun a bit. We still have to go through a re-rating of this economy to a lower growth environment, which means lower earnings growth, less activity, an employment shock, maybe jumping the gun just a bit more or a bit too much if we get too bullish on rate cuts at this juncture, given the context.
Hey, Francis, thank you. As always, Francis Donald there, just brilliant. I've run Manulife Investment Management. Joining us now is Alessio De Longis, Senior Portfolio Manager at Invesco. Alessio, you started the year constructive. You came into March less constructive. Alessio, talk to me about the change there, given what we've seen transpire in the last couple of weeks.
Lisa, John, thank you for having me. Yes, at the beginning of the year, we had a very constructive view, which panned out a little too fast and too far. So when we entered in March, many of our indicators started signaling a little bit of an extended price action and sentiment that was beginning to roll over as a result of renewed positive inflation surprises, bear steepening in yield curves, and the repricing of additional policy hikes. That led us to, from a cyclical perspective, to reposition again for a defensive asset allocation posture. What happened with the banking developments over the last couple of weeks has accelerated that path, has validated that path, but it's important to make a distinction. We have been able over the last couple of weeks to rule out, thanks to the policy actions and the developments in Switzerland, to rule out a systemic accident in the banking sector. With that being said, the tensions in the credit markets have increased. From a cyclical perspective, wider credit spreads, wider lending, more restrictive lending standards, and lower credit growth are necessary conditions to have monetary policy tighten in the future and bring inflation down.
Alessio, there seems to be a policy divergence driven by the fact that the U.S. financial system, and I'm talking not about the big banks, but the regionals that are subject to some of this deposit flight, that the banking system does have a more pervasive issue that needs to get dealt with than some other nations, including the U.K. and including Europe more broadly, continental Europe. Do you agree with that? Can you trade on that? Is there something underpinning that in terms of perhaps ongoing rate hikes in Europe and the end of them in the U.S.?
I think the cyclical divergence is there in growth and in monetary policy. On the margin, from this point on, I think with the Federal Reserve, we're looking at marginal increases, let's say another 25 basis points hike in May. But the ECB and potentially the Bank of England, I think, have more to go, at least another 50, if not more. That cyclical divergence can be expressed through multiple venues. Again, I'm ruling out I wouldn't say that we can trade on the more structural systemic aspects of potential bank regulation. I think what we should focus on is trading on that cyclical divergence, trading on the cyclicality of the price action, which I think has returned. The last couple of weeks were more of a risk of a systemic shock that would have changed that dynamic. But I think now we are more comfortably back into the typical end of a tightening cycle pricing dynamics.
So when can you go back into European banks?
European banks are not for now, in my mind. We favor a bias away from value and away from cyclicals, of which banks are one, more into quality-oriented, lower volatility and growth-oriented sectors. So defensive sectors such as healthcare, consumer staples, and even technology, which screens now on quality characteristics. And we have seen that quality pan out as soon as rates began to rally again. Those sectors and styles with longer dated cash flows and more duration have outperformed. We think this is an environment for defensive sectors.
Alessio, just quickly, just to wrap it up, are you working on the assumption now the Fed is done?
Working on the assumption that one more hike and then we are done. So cyclical divergence in favor of European equities, in favor of the euro, and a global backdrop where a policy being done is not necessarily the recipe for a rally just yet. We need to see the impact on growth first.
Interesting. Alessio, thank you. Alessio De Longis there of Invesco.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Joining us now in this equity market, John Stolfus, the Chief Investment Strategist at Oppenheimer Asset Management. Hey, John, great to catch up with you, sir. I mentioned this during the commercial break. We're going to talk about exactly this. If the Fed backs away because things are breaking, are you telling me that's bullish?
No, it's certainly not a bad thing. Let's put it that way. And I think the market really responded to that intimation from Chair Powell. And I think that, you know, that was all really doing quite well. And later on, we had this from Secretary of Treasury Janet Yellen, and that would kind of shook people up. But this is not uncommon, times like this. The main thing, it's not so much what brings the market down, is how quick the response is, and a recognition investors need to realize not every response is going to be correct or exactly what they want to hear. But it's a process of working our way back out of another set of wooded area, so to speak.
The set of wooded area we're going to get out of somehow with rate cuts. That's what the market says. The Fed says no. How much are you counting on rate cuts to have a more bullish outlook on how this emerges, how this develops, how we emerge from the woods of financial systemic issues?
Great question, Lisa. Not really relying on rate cuts a heck of a lot near term. I think the inflation is sticky. The Fed has to do something. Its credibility is still on the line. But its credibility is always on that line, whether it's a rate hike cycle or a cutting cycle. But in this particular instance, having been behind the curve badly enough, so we had this inflation hit the 40-year highs the way it had. This is an important period, and they've got to show that they can manage both this as well as a crisis in confidence within the regional banks. And I think they can, and I think they're very capable of doing it, but it doesn't mean they are infallible. They just have to work their way through a process.
John, you've been a bullish investor for quite a while. What does being a bull right now mean? What does it mean owning, and what does it mean hoping for?
Well, I think the main thing right now is, you know, we've just been building our positions in areas that we think will be rewarded. And if I just take a look, and I hate to give the Bears, you know, some areas they might hit, you know, if they get bugged out today at some point. But it's been terrific, where all of a sudden tech has become the new value story. There was a recognition all of a sudden that indeed we're not going back to the abacus or going back to the slide rule. Technology is alive and well. The most important thing is it's got to be profitable. You know, positive cash flow is a good thing. But as well as that, it looks good for consumer discretionary. It looks good for areas, communication services, industrials. And this is the area where we like to invest, not play. A little bit longer on the financials now. This is going to take to regain trust in terms of investors who are not players, but are rather intermediate to longer term investors. It'll take them a little while to feel more relaxed about financials as this gets cleared up.
Well, we need the consumer to relax about financials before investors can relax about financials. John, you need policy to act as a circuit breaker. Do you think this financial instability can end without blanket deposit insurance?
Yeah, you know, I think that the real definition is will have to be perhaps a redefining about what that that maximum amount of a deposit that gets covered, and then anything over that would likely have to be paid by the depositor in being over and having an overage versus what the covered amount is, so that the taxpayer is not really on the hook for it.
John Stolfus of Oppenheimer Asset Management. John, thank you.
Mark Warner joining us, the senator from Virginia, who is leading up some of those hearings in front of the House, in front of the Senate committee, as we do expect a no-win situation right now for the chief executive officer of TikTok. Can you give us a sense of what you're hoping to get out of the these hearings, Senator Warner?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not going to be in the hearing. It's actually a hearing today in the House. But I've had concerns for some time that the United States has not had any kind of rational policy about how we deal with foreign technologies from countries like China and Russia that pose a national security threat. A few years back, it was the Russian software company Kaspersky. Back in 2019, we went through a long debate about Huawei. Now we're talking about TikTok. So I put a bipartisan bill together that's been endorsed by the administration. I got 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans that said we ought to give the Secretary of Commerce the authorities and tools that could, if there is a national security threat, allow her to take actions up to and including divestiture and including banning. And why TikTok? Two reasons. One, you know, TikTok is extraordinarily popular. Let me acknowledge that. 150 million Americans. Some of the data I've seen, on average, about 90 minutes a day. What TikTok's genius is it learns from you every time you're on. So it's getting and collecting data that is individually specific. At the end of the day, no matter what the TikTok CEO says, Chinese law made clear in 2017 that ByteDance, Chinese company that owns TikTok, at any point, the Chinese government can require that data be turned over to the government. I think that has the ability to harvest data that could be used. It's already been demonstrated to be used to spy on journalists. It could be used to target certain people in the Chinese diaspora. It could be, frankly, used to ultimately target some of our kids who are on that site on such a regular basis. So the data collection is number one. The number two part is this is a huge potential propaganda tool. Should President Xi decide that he wants to go ahead and take on an invasion of China, or I'm sorry, invasion of Taiwan, TikTok could be that site that is saying to literally hundreds of millions of folks all around the world, 150 million Americans, hey, that's not so bad in terms of the message that is conveyed. And evidence of that in many ways has been the Chinese leadership has said they would rather have TikTok banned in America than give up the source code which is the secret sauce, the algorithms that create this wonderfully addictive tool, they would rather give up TikTok in America than give up the source code. And I don't know how Americans could ever be safe without that source code and getting out of China and into the United States.
Senator Warner, just before, so I want to make sure that we get this point clarified, just to dig into what you're saying a little bit more. You're talking about national security concern and how this data can be used to be manipulative to a broad swath of the public. But there's also this question, as you said, of learning from you and data collection. How do you draw the distinction between TikTok's use of this as being a company that's owned and headquartered in China versus social media companies in the U.S. that also collect data and also have a lot of learning tools from their users?
Great, great question. And candidly, I've got some concerns about the American companies. I think it's an embarrassment that we don't have a national privacy law. I think it's crazy. I'm a former telecom guy that we don't have an ability to have data portability and interoperability. So if you get tired of Facebook, you can move to a new site and basically still talk to your friends. I think it's crazy that we've not taken on what's called Section 230, which gives all these social media companies a get out of jail free card for any of the content that they post. We've not been able to move on it. But all of those concerns I have about American and British and Indian and other companies, those concerns are not national security based. They are, I think, basic fairness and business practices based. End of the day, TikTok, ByteDance, its Chinese parent, I believe has to be obligated by Chinese law, changed in 2017, made very clear that every Chinese company ultimately is not responsible to shareholders or customers. It is responsible to the government. And the fact that this can end up this data or this potential content manipulation can end up in the hands of the Communist Party, that moves this platform into the realm, in my mind, of national security. And one of the things that my law would also do is require the intelligence community to declassify as much information as possible, so it's not just a case of, hey, trust us, that this is a security risk. And I do believe that should this action take place, that the market will create an alternative. All these folks who are making money off of TikTok, social influencers, I believe there will be other sites. There are already some, maybe not as quite as attractive yet as TikTok, but there will be other sites. And that can be companies in America, in India, in France, you name it. I think the market will provide that alternative.
Senator Mark Warner, thank you so much for your comments. And we look forward to catching up with you after the House hearings and after this has developed even further.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Lisa Abramowitz, and this is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.